Welcome back to Generals and Napoleon, episode 73, General Thomas Picton of the British Army. Before we begin, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that if you'd like to support our podcast monetarily, please go to patreon.com/generals and Napoleon. I'd also like to give a shout out to our current Patreon members. We couldn't do this show without you, and we appreciate your support. If you'd like to support our podcast in other ways, please go to Spotify, YouTube, or Instagram and give us a follow. And if you like what you hear, give us a like. Now, on with the show. We have another wonderful special guest on the phone with us today. We have the great Graham Callister. Hello, Graham. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jim.
For those of you who don't know, Graham is an author. And he has a terrific book entitled Battle, Understanding Conflict from Hastings to Helmand. And you can find this through Pen & Sword Publishing or on Amazon. If you give us a brief overview, I think we can kind of figure out what the book is about. But what do you kind of explore within the book?
So the book looks at the idea of battle and how they're won and lost, essentially, by looking at a series of themes. So looking at how society impacts on a battle, or how logistics or leadership or weapons or tactics, how they each would impact on a battle, how they lead to essentially victory and defeat in combat. So we take me and a co-author, we take the span over about 1,000 years, but look at it thematically across this huge span of history.
Yeah, I've often had trouble with defining what is a victory or what is a loss in battle. And to me, I usually just attribute it to whoever holds the battlefield or a castle or a ground after a siege. Is that kind of how you define it?
Yeah. Who holds the land, or who gains their objectives? If your objective is simply to buy time, then you can sacrifice the territory if you get time for it. On the other hand, if your aim is to destroy an enemy, you could hold the battlefield, but if the enemy get away, you haven't really gained a victory. So I guess if you have other aims as well, they need to be taken into account. But if we're just talking about two forces who just want to dominate a campaign space, then I suppose, you know, whoever holds the ground is the victor at the end of the day.
Yeah. And the general we're going to discuss today is General Thomas Picton. But regarding what you just defined, like maybe buying time, like Marshal Ney's rear guard in Portugal or in Russia, even though those are during a retreat, he accomplishes his objective of buying time, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely. His job is to protect the rest of the army. It's not to hold that land at any cost. So he is going to give up that territory slowly. But it is really in how good order he withdraws, in how good order he allows the rest of the army to withdraw, that defines his success. And I think Ney, in both instances you mentioned, you're quite right. He is a master there of gaining tactical victories while retreating.
Okay. I knew he was my favorite for a reason. So thank you for backing me up on that. But the gentleman we're going to discuss, General Thomas Picton, was born in August 1758 in Wales, the seventh of 12 children to Thomas Picton and his wife, Cecile. Did he have an aristocratic background?
It's not aristocratic as such, but he is landed gentry. So they're of the class that own quite a lot of land. They are looked up to by the local community. They're seen as the big local figures, but he doesn't have a title. He's not one of the big aristocrats of the country, but his family does have money and they have influence. He has influential uncles and they will help him in his career. His brother Edward, for example, becomes a reverend as well, and Thomas, as we'll talk about, has to go into the military. So they still kind of have to do stuff in life. But he's born into a wealthy, privileged background.
Very good.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah, in 1771, he attains a commission as an ensign. And by 1778, he has worked his way up to captain. And he later plays a notable part in quelling a mutiny. kind of get slightly off topic here. Why were mutinies so common in this era, both in the army and the navy?
Well, the mutiny that Picton deals with comes at the end of the American War of Independence or American Revolution, however you want to phrase it. By this stage, he's been an officer for 12 years. He's risen to a captaincy, and he's actually the senior officer in his regiment at this point, the 75th Regiment. And at the end of this war in 1783, the British government wants to draw down the army and get rid of excess soldiers, save money, basically. And the 75th is one of the battalions, the regiments, scheduled to be disbanded. Now, this is a period where soldiers aren't paid much anyway. They haven't had a pay rise for almost a century. That applies to the Navy as well. Conditions are generally poor in the army. Morale isn't great. There's not a huge relationship between officers and men. Normally, the sergeants act as kind of a buffer zone between them. There's not a huge amount of trust between them. And these soldiers who are going to be dismissed feel that they're just being kicked out. They're going to have nothing. And so when Picton goes and reads out the government's announcement, there's basically a mutiny from the soldiers. They disperse from the parade ground. They go and start muttering. They start to refuse to give up their weapons and threaten that they're going to rampage. They're in Bristol at the time. And they threaten to rampage through the town. And Picton, you know, shows his early leadership here. He, when he hears about this, basically goes down to the scene of the mutiny, draws his sword, storms into the crowd of soldiers, grabs hold of the ringleader by the scruff of the neck, drags him out, throws him off to a couple of NCOs to be arrested, reads the riot act to the rest of the soldiers, gives them a proper dressing down, and quells the mutiny basically by force of personality and by a couple of NCOs dragging off this ringleader to the guardhouse. Wow. I think this kind of shows a bit about these mutinies. They're about soldiers feeling disgruntled, feeling they're not being given their due deserts. And in this case, you know, soldiers fearing what's going to come after being disbanded when there's no pensions, no job prospects.
Yeah, and I do kind of feel for them to serve your country in what turned out to be a losing war, and then to be told to go home or not paying you anymore. That must have been hard to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. This happens at the end of the Napoleonic Wars as well. And Britain is not very good in this period of dealing with those who serve it well.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, well, around this time, though, Picton goes into retirement, doesn't he, on his father's estate?
Yeah, so in 1783, he's made what's called half pay. So when officers are part of a regiment that's disbanded, they normally are put into kind of a reserve force on half pay. And he petitions for a position. His uncle, who'd got him the commission in the first place, is asked to try to find him something. But after 10 years of petitioning, he still can't find a position in the army. You know, there just aren't enough. So he basically goes home to the family estate. He's not doing much in this period. He is trying to get back into the military. He's just left unemployed.
Yeah, just living the life as a country gentleman, I guess. However, he's finally brought back to serve as a major in the British Army in the West Indies in 1793. What qualities do you think overall he had that made him stand out? I know there's obviously a lot of officers. He was known to be courageous, but the Duke of Wellington later described him as, quote, a rough, foul-mouthed devil as ever lived, end quote.
Yeah, absolutely. Although the second half of that is, but he always behaved extremely well. No man could do better in the services I assigned to him. So, you know, what Wellington recognizes, although he's Picton is personally a bit rough and ready. He dresses very poorly. He's got bad manners. He's quite blunt, says what he thinks. Despite all of that, Picton is actually an officer who will do what you ask him. Make things happen. And I think Picton shows in the 1790s, the glimpses of what will come. He clearly has courage, you know, from facing down the mutineers in 1783 to the actions he takes in the 1790s over in the Caribbean. He shows personal courage in combat and also, like I say, against the mutineers. He is quite forthright, which makes him enemies. It makes people think he's foul-mouthed, but also it can be a bonus. Telling people what you think and telling people when they're doing something daft can be quite praised. personally, he's actually physically quite imposing. He's about 6'1". He's a stern man. He seems quite imposing. He's got a sharp voice. He has apparently a quick and animated manner of speaking, which makes him kind of an almost, you know, overbearing person. Mm-hmm. Although people say he's calm and impressive in action. But he seems like this kind of large, courageous figure who's going to say it like it is. He's also actually quite intelligent. He can speak Spanish. He learned that when he was on garrison duty in Gibraltar in the 1770s. It turns out he's quite colloquial in French. His junior officers, his aides in 1815, are astounded to find that he can speak really good French. He spends the 10 years on his father's farm improving his mind. You know, he reads a lot of the classics. He reads a lot of manuals of military warfare. He'd also spent time in France at a military academy during his younger years. So, you know, this mix of being a courageous, large figure, quite forthright, quite intelligent, serve him well in these early years in the 1790s.
Yeah, indeed. But leaning into that, in terms of his irascibility, he was made governor of the colony of Trinidad in 1797. And what occurs is one of the largest stains on his service record. He's accused of torture and unlawful execution of some of the residents there. Could you tell us a little bit about what happened there?
Yeah, so when he goes to the Caribbean, he doesn't have a position. He petitions the local commander, a chap called Vaughan, who gives him a commission. And then when Sir Ralph Abercrombie comes over, Picton acts as his aide, and he impresses so much that he's made governor of Trinidad in 1797 when the British take it, and they take it off the Spanish.
Right.
Now, the garrison he's given to look after Trinidad is pretty small, and he feels under-equipped and undermanned to do what's being asked of him, which is to hold the island against the potential of a Spanish resurrection or a Spanish return or French intervention or a slave uprising. And so he decides that the best thing to do is to rule with an iron fist, basically to rule by fear. He would rather be feared than loved. And so he decides, you know, swift and harsh justice is needed. And so he's involved in a series of kind of judicial decisions that are a bit dodgy, a bit underhand. A lot of executions that happen with only the barest minimum of legal cover. Torture that's being conducted against suspects, which he says is legal because it's under Spanish law. His instructions are to rule the islands under Spanish law. He thinks there's a huge amount of corruption, so he tries to clamp down on that, but then he himself is accused of it because he's speculating in land and slaves and lining his own pockets. So it's a situation where Picton thinks he has to rule harshly, but people in Britain don't take that attitude. So basically, when the war ends, in 1802, when the peace treaty is signed, Trinidad remains British, and new officers are sent out to take over, and they're appalled by what they found of Picton's governorship. They say he was too harsh. They say he was being corrupt. They say that, you know, he wasn't ruling according to the law, and they basically accuse him of misdemeanors. He resigns. He goes back to Britain, where he's arrested and put on trial.
Mm-hmm.
He's accused mostly of things like arbitrary execution, and he points out, well, actually, I obeyed Spanish law. Under Spanish law, all of this was fine. The prosecution are forced to accept this, and so he's found not guilty in this trial. But then in 1806, another prosecution is brought against him. So this is 3 years after he's left the island. And this right. one is a specific charge, as you said, of torture, of a 14-year-old girl, Louisa Caldron, who was accused of abetting a crime, and the local magistrate had asked Picton, can I torture her to get information? And Picton had said yes.
Yeah, I was reading about that. He permitted the use of picketing, which I guess is basically you hang someone by one of their arms from a ceiling and they have to like balance on like a small block of wood. Is that how it goes?
Yeah, absolutely. And this punishment was used in the British Army as well, in the earlier 18th century, apparently. But yeah, basically you kind of strung up from the ceiling by an arm and then balanced on this tiny peg with a toe, puts huge pressure through the leg and the toe. So yeah, it's a torture device. And Picton's accused of allowing torture, which is illegal. His defense is basically it's not illegal. In Spain, torture is fine. The prosecution said torture might happen in Spain, but in the Spanish West Indies, it's never been used. So de facto, it should be illegal. And things go back and forth. But in 1806, he is actually found guilty because the jury decides that torture should not be allowed, was not allowed in the Spanish West Indies, and therefore Picton was guilty of a crime.
Right.
So, you know, this is a big stain in his reputation. Picton then appeals, though, and asks for a new trial. That happens in 1808, so we're 5 years now after he's left Trinidad. And he argues in the new trial that, again, this was legal. He brings more testimony to prove that torture was legal and that he was just obeying the law. And the jury accept that. But what they don't accept is that his actions should not have been seen as so repugnant to an Englishman that he should have not done them anyway. So the other argument, that, you know, it's not much of a legal argument, but they basically say, okay, this was legal, but it's so disgusting as a crime that you as an English officer, they use the term English, even though he's Welsh, but you as a British officer should have known that this is not the done thing. And the court is asked to consider that, and it promises it will return a verdict, but then never does. So wow. he is acquitted formally, yeah. But there is always this thing hanging over him for the rest of his life and career.
Yeah, because he didn't deny it. He agreed. You know, he did do it, but he just tried to get out on a technicality, which I could see why that would not look good on his career overall. But we'll come back to that. In the meantime, though, somehow he's promoted to Major General in 1810. And at Wellington's request, Picton was given command of a division in Spain against Napoleon's armies. How did all that happen? How did Picton get into the Peninsular War?
Yeah, so he's promoted in April of 1808 to Major General. And this is during the scandal. So you suspect he has powerful supporters who want him to be got off with this. And in 1809, he goes to Walcheren in the British invasion of the Netherlands. Serves as governor of Flushing for a brief time. Mm-hmm. And then in 1810, when Wellington's in the peninsula, he's in need of fighting generals. He is in need of people to lead his divisions who are going to take it to the French, who are not simply going to be appointees for political reasons. And General Miranda, who is kind of a bit of an adventurer of the period, had served the French and was now on side with the British, he advises Wellington to appoint Picton. And he says, no, he's seen Picton in the Caribbean. He knows he's a fighting man. He's a forthright man. And Wellington, having never met him, writes to London and says, can you send Picton, please? I suspect London's quite happy to get rid of him. So they send him out and he's appointed to a command in the peninsula.
Yeah, and I think it's an interesting point, the term fighting generals, because Wellington probably had enough of these, you know, couch cushion generals like Dalrymple and the other guy from Vimero. He probably wanted nothing of that kind, like country gentleman generals. He wanted a guy who would be in the front lines.
Yeah, someone like, you know, Burrard or Dalrymple, who's going to just, you know, play it safe, retreat, negotiate, surrender even. He doesn't want them. He wants men who are going to see an enemy and attack them.
Okay.
Who are going to hold firm, who aren't going to panic if the French send a large attack their way, who are going to stand firm. And, you know, Picton becomes for him, you know, along with Crawford, along with Hill, one of his most trusted subordinates.
Yeah, I've read that. You know, obviously he gave Hill and Crawford a lot of latitude. I think he trusted Picton, but I don't know if he gave him as much of a free hand as he did the others.
Yeah, absolutely. He never has semi-independent commands like Hill or even Crawford, and certainly not anything as much as Beresford or Graham, who have their own kind of, you know, theatres to deal with at different times. Mm-hmm. In 1814, he is offered an independent command on the East Coast, but turns it down. So I think he's trusted by Wellington. He seems a good fighting general, but Wellington does keep him under his eye a bit more than the other kind of, you know, major general or main generals he's got.
Right. Well, he fights well at Bisaco, Fuentes de Enoro, El Bodón. In 1812, he participates in the sieges of Ciudad Rodrigo and Badajoz. At the Badajoz battle, his efforts are pivotal in capturing the fort, but he's wounded for his efforts. Do you know kind of what happens in that battle? I know it's a pretty big one.
Badajoz in the siege, his division is tasked with basically making a diversion against the castle, while the other divisions storm the breaches. And it turns out actually that they can't get through the breaches, but Picton's division manages to scale the walls of the castle, get in and open the city from the inside. So his division's absolutely crucial in taking this city, even though it was just meant to be a diversion, really, to draw French attention in the first place. So that kind of shows the measure of the man and the men under his command as well.
Indeed. But he is wounded, as I mentioned. He has to return to Britain for a time to recover. Regarding his personal life, was he ever married? Did he have kids?
I don't think he's married, actually. He does have children, or at least rumored to have children illegitimately in Trinidad. He has a mistress there who bears him 3 or 4 children, I think. Mm-hmm. But I don't think he ever got married. Certainly when the country wants to reward him after Waterloo, they give pensions to his sisters, which indicate that they're the kind of next of kin, rather than a wife. So I don't think he married.
Got it. Okay. Well, apparently he recovers because he returns to the Peninsula War in 1813 in time for the final Battle of Vitoria, which drives Napoleon's troops basically permanently out of Spain. His military conduct again earns praise, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. At Vitoria, he's part of kind of Wellington's plan to outflank the French positions. And his division basically storms a bridge that's crucial to crossing the river, things like the River Zadora, and outflank these French positions. His men storm the bridge successfully and then hold it against a major battery of artillery and a counterattack as well. About a third of the casualties at Vitoria on the Allied side are in Picton's division. And this shows his leadership, but also his tenacity in defense. And, you know, bolsters this reputation he's been building.
Yeah, indeed. That's a pretty stubborn defense to lose a third of your division and just stay put. Regarding the rest of the, obviously, the Peninsula War goes well. Napoleon abdicates in April 1814. And for a brief while, the British Army is kind of they have some downtime because in their minds, the war is over. Do you know what Picton was doing during this downtime?
Yeah, he wanted to retire. He went back to Wales to his estates, intending to retire from the army. He's quite upset that he gets passed over for a peerage, so he's not made a lord for his efforts in the peninsula when just about everyone else is. And he suspects this is because, you know, he rubs people up the wrong way and doesn't have the right manners. But he is kind of promoted to the Knight Grand Cross of the Order of the Bath, which is, you know, a promotion within the knighthood. But he's 56 years old, you know, from August of 1814. He's tired and he wants to hang up his sabre. So he starts to manage his estate. He looks to invest in the local area. He's the Member of Parliament for Pembrokeshire. So he is basically looking to retire from 1814.
Well, unfortunately for Picton, Wellington, and the rest of the Allied army, Napoleon returns in 1815, so they can't retire just yet. And Picton is again found serving under Wellington at Waterloo against d'Erlon's corps. What happens in this final battle? I know it doesn't end well for Picton.
Yeah, alas. Well, Picton's appointed to the army quite late in 1815. He receives orders or instructions in May, to head out to the army. But he only departs Britain on the 13th of June and only arrives in Brussels on the morning of the 15th. And that very night, he's already marching out of the city with his men to face Napoleon's invasion, which, of course, began on the 15th. On the 16th, Picton, for a while, is leading the defence at Quatre Bras alongside Perponcher's 2nd Netherlands Division. So his 8 battalions hold a crucial part of the line for a crucial part of the battle, and they lose massively. You know, 3 of his battalions lose half their strength, 3 more lose a third of their strength, and the other 2 lose an eighth. So these are big casualties. Picton himself leads from the front, shows his ingenuity. At one stage, he attacks French cavalry with his infantry, you know, such as his desire to hold the line. But he himself gets wounded in this battle. He's shot in the ribs, but he hides it from everyone. He doesn't want to leave the campaign, so he hides his wound.
Yeah, and again, he's facing our old friend Marshal Ney in that battle. So I know it was a tough fight. I know we have trouble defining what a victory or a loss was. I'd say that was more of a draw, that particular battle.
Yeah, absolutely. The two commanders both had their aims, and neither of them achieved everything, but they did deny their aim to the enemy. So it's a draw, I think, Quatre Bras. And you know, Ney gets criticized a bit for it, but you know, the tenacity of someone like Picton there you know, is something that you just can't account for. And Picton does really well, but 2 days later, he's there at Waterloo, leading his division again. And this is, you know, the final battle for him.
Yeah. What are kind of his final moments like? What happens to him?
So he's holding the Allied center left, essentially, with Perponche's division just ahead of him. And Durland launches a huge attack from the French center right, about 20,000 men coming towards these 13 Allied battalions. Bylund's brigade of Perponche's division is brushed out the way, so it's down to Picton, and he launches his men into a counterattack. His 8th Brigade into the French 1st and 2nd Divisions, and his 9th Brigade into the 3rd Division. And Picton's there, waving his top hat above his head, of course. He's not in uniform, he's in civilian clothes. He's urging his men on when a stray shot, probably stray rather than aimed, smacks him in the forehead and kills him instantly. Some controversy as to where this happened, whether he was leading the 8th Brigade or the 9th Brigade forward. But he is killed instantly in this first attack. And so ends a military career that stretches back all the way to 1771.
Yeah, and I know the Duke of Wellington, he had trouble writing out his condolences letter on his loss. I'm sure it was felt throughout the British Army.
Yeah, absolutely. There's an officer of the 2nd of the 95th, so of the Rifles, who wrote, "Poor Sir Thomas Picton, he was a great man. The army will remember him as long as memory lasts." So, you know, there's a lot of mourning of Picton after he dies. I think his death, like so many others, kind of covers up a lot of faults. The fact that he died at this moment of victory for the country makes people not think of his faults, but think of his service.
Yeah, let's finish upon that. It is a controversial legacy. How would you describe his overall service?
His military service, I think he's a very good general in the field. He's a solid general. He gives good service in the peninsula. He was tenacious in defense, relatively innovative in attack. He had a good eye for terrain and a good eye for a formation. He did what needed to be done. And I think he's quite a useful subordinate because he does speak his mind, and he does let people know what he thinks. But I also don't think we can divorce that from the less savory aspects of his character. Some of these actions might only be controversial to us because we have different ideas today, but we can't forget that actually they were controversial at the time because some people at the time found them so abhorrent. So his support for torture, executions that were barely judicial, and of course the slave trade. So he has these aspects to his character, but as a general, he was definitely good. And you know, the memory of him as well through the 19th century especially was revered. Robinson, H.B. Robinson, who writes in 1836 a memoir or a biography of Picton, writes, "His brilliant career and glorious death have wholly removed the stigma which upon that occasion was attempted to be inflicted on his name." Dalton, who wrote a book on Waterloo officers, said that Picton's memory is dear to every Briton. So certainly in the 19th century, he was absolutely revered, but I think now we do need to look at him in a bit more nuanced way.
Yeah, and I know he ruffled some of his colleagues' feathers as well. I believe at the Battle of Koa, he refused to come help Crawford because he told Crawford he wasn't following orders as Wellington had laid them out. So it sounds like he also had some trouble working well with others.
Yeah, absolutely. And that instance shows, one, Crawford being a bit hot-headed, and two, Picton maybe being a bit literal with his orders. Although, you know, Wellington's the kind of man that likes a general who obeys orders, so... I suspect he preferred Picton's approach.
Yeah, indeed. Well, I thank you for that overview, my friend. That was fantastic. I appreciate you educating us on Thomas Picton. And again, if you want to learn more about Graham and his book, I recommend you go to Amazon or Pen and Sword and check it out. And yeah, thank you so much, my friend.
Thank you very much.